The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. 5,000 years of wisdom on demand. Get your first month for only 99 cents. Visit Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim to see what's happening on the largest consciousness media streaming platform in the world. Thanks, Gaia. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by the Kent Paranormal Weekend. April 29th and 30th, I'll be there leading panel presentations and speaking. Joining me will be Jeff Belanger and Nick Redfern and a host of other paranormal experts. I hope you will join us there in Kent, Ohio. And you can find out more information at thekentstage.com. That's thekentstage.com. See you there.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you. And thanks so much for all of your support of the shows. If you enjoy what we do, please rate, review, and most importantly, subscribe through Apple Podcasts or iTunes or wherever you listen. Hit the subscribe button because that really does help move us up the charts. And we have some stiff competition these days, so we need your help to keep us on the top of the charts for paranormal podcasts. Probably the originator, seeing that it is the paranormal podcast back in 2005. So we want to stay at the top of the charts, and we really need your help. So please do that if you can today, maybe while you're listening. Please do. It helps us tremendously. And we have a great show for you today. We're going to start off with G. Michael Vasey. He's going to talk to us about the black-eyed demons, and he's going to talk about his recent book, The Black-Eyed Demons Are Coming, True Accounts to Keep You Awake Tonight. And that's certainly frightening, but no more frightening than part two. In part two, we're going to talk to Len Kasten, and he's going to talk about Alien World Order, the reptilian plan to divide and conquer the human race. So all in all, hold on to your seats because we have a really spooky show. We're talking about black-eyed demons and then aliens who are going to try to divide and conquer us. Whew. It's a lot to digest. Here it is, the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest today is a return guest, G. Michael Vasey, and we are going to talk about a topic that fascinates me. Now, G. Michael has done many books on the supernatural, but I don't think anyone is more fascinating than a topic we're going to talk about tonight. That is, the black-eyed demons are coming. That's True Accounts to Keep You Awake Tonight, True Tales of Terror, True Horror Stories, Creepy Stories, Real Black Eyed Kids Account. This is part of his Paranormal Eyewitness series. And G. Michael, these black eyed kids, black eyed demons, call them what you will, very frightening stuff.
Yeah. Actually, for me, it all started, as you know, I've got a website that people submit stories to from time to time. And it started about 18 months ago when I first got a black-eyed kid story through. And to be honest, until I saw that submission, I really hadn't heard of them. Sitting over on this side of the Atlantic, you know, it's not such a big deal. It seems to have, as we'll discover over the next 30 minutes, I suppose, it does seem to have a U.S.-centric aspect to it. So I got this story in, and I'm probably, you're probably a bit like me, you become immune to the normal stories, but this one actually had me, you know, thinking, oh my goodness me, what would I do if I heard a tapping on my door at 4 o'clock in the morning, and when I went to the door, there was two kids stood there, and it really grabbed my attention. We put it on the site, and it went viral. I got more traffic to the site over that one story than perhaps we'd had for any other story in the history of the site. And then, of course, the floodgates opened, and all of these stories started coming in. And after a while, I began to think, well, maybe I should look at this a bit more carefully, a bit more closely. So I started doing some Googling around, doing a bit of research. And in fact, the first Black Eyed Kid book I put out was some time ago. It was in the Your Haunted Life series. It was number three, Black Eyed Kids. And it's one of the few books that I've written that, at least on the Amazon side, not the code.uk side, but on the Amazon.com side, almost has exclusively five-star reviews. So plainly, it's a book that people enjoyed, and a lot of comments about, my goodness me, you know, don't make the same mistake as me. I read this before I went to bed, and I haven't slept all night. So it's one of these urban myths, I suppose, that really grabs people's attentions and really causes them to think. And I mean, as I've put these books together, even the last one, I must confess, I still smoke the odd cigarette, and sometimes I step out back onto a dark patio late at night, and after writing or reading one of these stories, I have to peer around the corner carefully to make sure that there's no small child there looking at me with black eyes, you know.
Yeah, it'll get your attention for sure. Now, let's say that someone is out there listening who is maybe new to the show, because we've talked about this before in my program with different people, David Weatherly and some other folks, but maybe somebody this is new to them. What is kind of the common story that you hear? Where are the commonalities? What happens?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there is a commonality to the story, particularly the US stories, and maybe we can get to the differences a bit later. But generally, the idea is, or the story normally goes, that unexpectedly there is, and this can take place in a house or a car, but let's take the house instance. Unexpectedly, there's a knocking, usually a soft knocking at the door, usually quite late at night or the early hours of the morning. When the occupant gets to the door, they're already feeling a sort of sense of discomfort. Some people describe it as fear of losing their soul, a deep-seated fear, irrational fear that they can't explain, even before they see what's on the doorstep. When they open the door, what they will generally find are a couple or maybe three small kids. The kids are often said to be dressed in dark sort of clothes, maybe quite formal, a little old-fashioned looking at times, you know, like little black suits, ties, white shirts, this kind of thing. Very abnormal sort of dress for small kids, 7-8-year-old kids. The kids will have this pale complexion, they will be very calm, and they will simply ask, can I come in? They may make some excuse, you know, we got lost, we've lost our parents, any of those kind of tales, but most usually all they want to do is to be let into the house. The other aspect of this is that usually, although the person who's answered the door is gripped with irrational fear, sweating and not feeling very good, feeling almost as if the energy is being drained out of them, they don't notice the black eyes because I suppose they're so stunned to find a troop of small kids stood on their doorstep at some early hour in the morning. And of course, your natural instinct kicks in. Well, hell, you know, why are some little kids on my doorstep? What's happened? Has there been a car crash? Have they got lost? What do I need to do? And yet I've got this sense of fear. And that's when usually they notice the black eyes. And when they notice the black eyes, that usually does the trick. And they will slam the door shut. The kids may continue to knock on the door, knock on the windows, ask to be let in. And, you know, the occupant will cower in fear, hoping that they'll go away. And that's usually the sort of storyline. There are variations on that. It could be you're sat in your car and you're approached by a small child who asks, can you give them a lift somewhere? But it's the same concept. Will you let me in? This irrational sense of fear, the fear of losing your soul or losing your life. And this storyline is repeated ad nauseum in different ways with different twists. Sometimes there are black-eyed adults with them up on the other side of the street, perhaps. Sometimes the kids have been seen in the neighborhood, sort of watching the house for a few days. Sometimes adults show up and the kids get into a car and drive away. Sometimes the kids will say really kind of strange things like, can I use your telegraph as opposed to the telephone, which kind of, again, infers an earlier era. So those are all sort of like the things that are in the mix. And of course, the black eyes, I mean, Hollywood uses black eyes to denote demonic possession, and black eyes have always, I think, had that sort of inference throughout human history. A lot of the early, you know, monsters in the woods had black eyes and this kind of thing, so that the pitch black eyes really frighten people.
Now,
so that's kind of the story.
And the thing to me is that, and you kind of struck on it there, the reason I think that these stories resonate is you take the most innocent of yes. the society, and your instinct is to help them and to be open to whatever they're saying, but then you have this sinister overtone. You kind of, it's kind of like a thunderstorm, you know, when cold air hits warm air, there's like this. Yep. This thunder, you're taking the innocent, and then you're taking something that's very sinister. It seems sinister and evil, and it's kind of clashing, and it's kind yes. of creating this thunderclap of fear.
Absolutely.
So here is the question, because I don't think anybody really has an answer to this, but theories. I've heard things like they're kind of like mini Men in Black. Maybe they're from another time. Maybe they're shapeshifters of some time. Maybe they're, as in the title of yours, maybe they're demons and they're coming to steal your soul. What are some of the different theories about what the black-eyed kids and the black-eyed demons are up to?
Well, all the above, and also that they're alien, that they're, you know, they're possessed by aliens, possessed by demons, that they're from another dimension, all of these kind of things. But I think if you really start to analyze all of the stories, and you broaden the search to look at the meaning of black eyes, how black eyes sometimes appear quite naturally in very angry humans. I mean, there are psychological accounts of people developing black eyes when they get very, very angry. And it's actually a condition that has a name. Don't ask me what it is, because I've forgotten, probably couldn't pronounce it anyway. But I think all of that comes into play. One of the other aspects often of the black-eyed kid or black-eyed person meeting is that they talk very in a sort of monotone. So there's also this hypnotic aspect. It's almost as if you're being hypnotized and you want to do something, which is let them in, right, against your will. And that hypnotic aspect to it, I think, is also compelling. When I looked at this in the first book, and that's what the first book was a series of accounts and a kind of exploration of what might this phenomena be, I came to the conclusion that they are demons and demonic. And the reason for that was their eye color, their behavior, but more importantly, this let me in. Let me into your car, let me into your house, because what this relates to is let me cross your threshold. And they say in sort of demonology and spiritualism that a demon needs your permission to enter your body. And so this let me in probably is taken as let me into your house, let me into your car. But the black-eyed kid is probably meaning let me in to possess you. Let me cross your threshold. Let me take over. And what's really weird about this whole, we'll call it an urban myth for now, but what's really weird and what's really compelling is, of all the hundreds of stories that I've read, I've only ever read two in which they were let in. And I think this is something that really is also quite scary, because, I mean, in the U.S., goodness knows how many people disappear every year.
Oh, yes.
But there are stories of black-eyed kids being spotted in a neighborhood where there are isolated homes and entire families going missing. And, you know, the linkage is obviously made between the black-eyed kids and the people going missing. But in the couple of accounts where they have been let in, they were only let in for a short time because another person or another adult came in and disrupted that hypnosis sort of environment and threw them out. And what has happened to the people since then is they've developed cancers, they've died of cancers, their pets have died of cancer, they've been very ill, they've been lethargic, lacking in soul, lacking in spirit. And so, again, you get this impression that this is a demonic thing. Now, I'm sure there are others that will argue with me, and I think all theories are still open. But this is my theory. This is the conclusion I came to as I did my investigation. And another aspect to this sort of urban myth that came up during my exploration of it was something quite startling called the white-eyed kid. So if you've heard of black-eyed kids, now imagine that there's another entity out there.
Yeah, I've not heard of those.
That has white eyes. And in the one or two or three stories where white-eyed kids have been involved, it would appear that they were hunting the black-eyed kids. So in a couple of stories, one person was being followed by some black-eyed kids. He was then confronted with another person who had entirely white eyes, who told him, "Leave them to us." And after that, he had no more problem with his black-eyed kids. So this concept of a white-eyed kid. Now, if you look at demonic hierarchies, black denotes the sort of base demon,
sure,
and white denotes the boss demon. So again, you have this kind of the white-eyed demon sort of chasing the black-eyed demon, and I found that quite intriguing as well. So there's definitely white-eyed kids as well as black-eyed kids, and let's face it, there are also black-eyed adults and white-eyed adults around. A lot of the stories that have been submitted to the site since I wrote these books have actually talked about adults.
Well,
asking.
We're going to get a couple of those stories. The black-eyed demons are coming, but they'll have to wait for this message. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. And keep listening, because I'm going to tell you how you can get your first month for only 99 cents. Now, you are a Paranormal Podcast listener, so you're obviously interested in these kind of topics, the supernatural, the unusual, the strange, the Freudian. And you know where to go to get your audio fix of this kind of content, but there really is only one place to get that same kind of coverage, that same kind of information, but in video, and get in-depth stuff. You're not just scratching the surface. And the place you go for that is Gaia, because Gaia explores the topics we love, and they're always providing tremendous new content. For example, if you were a member this week, some interesting things that you could take a look at are Wisdom Teachings by David Wilcock. He talks about galactic geometry, cubes in space. It's talking about the law of one and how mainstream science is starting to see evidence of it. Galaxies can spontaneously reproduce themselves. This is the kind of info that you get on Gaia. Or perhaps you want to take a look at Missing Links, the bigger questions concerning who we are, where we come from, or where have we gone have captivated scientists and mystics for centuries. And Greg Braden's new show just this season. Now all episodes are available of Missing Links. And the list goes on and on with shows like Buzzsaw and Beyond Belief and Truth Hunter by Linda Moulton Howe. There's always something new, always something exciting on Gaia. Now, something Gaia has recently done that I think is really slick, they've set up a special page for us at Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. I love this because this is a little sampler of some of the different things you could see on Gaia if you were a member. For example, I'm looking here, Pushing the Limits of Disclosure with John Lear from the Cosmic Disclosure Show. Special Report, Mars Colony Inspection. Then you go down to the paranormal. You've got crop circles, crossovers from another dimension. And then you've got a clip from Beyond Belief, Revelations from Remote Viewing with Lynn Buchanan. And then another clip here, Contact Has Begun. Or Beyond the Conjuring with Andrea Perone. And she's been on our shows before. There's a metaphysics section. There's secrets and covers up, a cover-up section. I love what they've done here. I kind of like it. I call a guy a kind of a paranormal smorgasbord. And there's a little bit of something. And if you go to Gaia.com/Jim to look at these clips, there's absolutely no charge. So I highly recommend it. I'm really thankful that they set that up for us so we can take a look and you kind of get an idea of some things that you can check out. So I think you are going to love it. If you go to Gaia.com/Jim, there's a little red button that says sign up. And if you click on that, you'll have the opportunity to sign up for your first month for only 99 cents. Now, there's some other great offers, but that's an opportunity if you want to dip a toe into the water, sign up for only 99 cents for your first month. Gaia is great, and you're going to want to check it out. Visit Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim to see what's happening on the largest consciousness media streaming platform in the world. Thanks, Gaia. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is G. Michael Vasey. The subject are the black-eyed demons. Specifically, the black-eyed demons are coming. Now, fascinating subject, but we love stories on this show. Would you like to share one or two of your favorite stories that you've gathered over this time looking at this very, very strange phenomenon?
Yeah, one of the stories that actually isn't even in the books, it's been recently submitted, I found quite interesting. And this took place in London, where two ladies, two friends got on a tube, the metro in London, and one of them spotted a gentleman with black eyes. And it has all the elements where she was, you know, very, very scared. Then she noticed the black eyes, was even more scared. The friend never saw a thing. And as you know, she gets more and more panicky as the tube whistles through the underground there. And as soon as she can, she gets off. She's sweating. She's palpitating. She's scared. She's asking a friend, did you see him? Did you see him? Did he follow us? And the friend saw nothing. Never saw this person. Never saw this entity. Didn't experience any of the fear. And the reason why I like that particular story, and it is a new one that's been submitted recently, is because it infers, does it not, that perhaps these things are selectively visible as well as... yes, because one person saw this and was frightened to the point of, as I say, palpitations and cold sweats and really very frightened. And her friend, who was with her the whole time, was just puzzled by this behavior. There was nobody that she could see, certainly nobody with black eyes. And so there you have an example of where a black-eyed person is selectively seen and not seen by everybody. So is there a clue in there? The other kind of story that has fascinated me is, having lived 20 years of my life in Texas and actually being an American by passport, even though I live in Europe these days, you know, I often used to visit, as we do, Walmart. And Walmart to me is like the typical American experience. You know, it's a very large shop. It's full of everything you could possibly want to buy in vast quantities, in large quantities. It's full of all kinds of characters. And yet Walmart seems to be the setting for so many of the stories about black-eyed adults. Apparently, black-eyed adults shop at Walmart because I've had at least 15 stories of people. In particular, there's this lady. She goes shopping with her daughters. She's only going into Walmart for a couple of items. She leaves the daughters locked in the car. The daughters are not small kids, they're teenagers. And off she goes. The daughters are sitting in the car, and a small child comes along and runs a key along the side of the car, which is an eerie sound anyway, and starts asking if they would let him into the car. They have the same fear, the same irrational fear. Then they notice that this small child has black eyes. So they make sure all the doors are locked, and they sit there scared beyond belief until Mum arrives again, at which time the black-eyed child has disappeared. Mum gets in the car, they drive away, the kids start to explain to Mum what just happened, and the mother looks at them in shock because she had an encounter with a black-eyed woman in the store that had also caused her to be extremely concerned, who asked if she could be given a ride. So again, you wonder if sometimes, you know, these black-eyed kids selectively pick people, pick targets, and are only seen selectively by their targets. But Walmart seems to, if you want to have an encounter with a black-eyed adult and you live in the southern United States, I recommend Walmart.
That's interesting. Now, let me ask you this. Now, some people would say, if these things are real, why have they just seemed to have shown up on the scene in the last 10, 15, 20 years? It seems like it's, at least reports seem to be recent. Is that a misnomer? I mean, what are we talking about?
I think this is a misnomer. If you probably know that the guy giving the credit for introducing the urban myth of black-eyed kids was a man called Brian Bethel, a Texas reporter in Abilene, I believe, in Texas. And he had an experience where he was sat in a car and he was basically approached by some black-eyed kids. The story has all of the elements of the stories as we just related them. And this took place, it was related on a mailing list, I think in 1998, 1999, something like that. And then, of course, he was on TV in some Monsters and Mysteries in America series in the 2000s, and he related the story. And from there, it took off. But and everybody then believes that sort of Brian Bethel was made up the story or created the myth of the black-eyed kids. But in actual fact, I have had stories submitted to me on the website and that are in the two books that are set in the 1920s, the 1970s, set in the UK, set in France. There's nothing new about this encounter story. I think that Brian Bethel looked out because that was the time when the internet started to take off. That's when reality TV started to take off. And I think there's been an explosion of communication about these urban myths and a fascination with this kind of story ever since. But if you really do the research, these stories go back not just into last century, but throughout human history. Some Indian tribe in North America, for example, believed in some being of black-eyed, white-skinned people that lived in the forest, and if you were unfortunate enough to bump into them, you were never seen again. So the black-eyed kid and the black-eyed adult has been around, I think, for a lot longer than they're given credit for. And I do think there is something to the story. I don't think this is made up. I mean, all of these experiences, you know, there's got to be some truth that where there's smoke, there's fire. There's got to be some truth behind this. And of course, just to you and all the listeners on the show, they do say that once you've heard about black-eyed kids, you're more likely to meet them.
Oh boy. Oh boy. I didn't la, 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 la. I didn't hear anything.
You now, evil laugh.
So now one thing that, and you kind of spoke to it, is this idea that if you don't let them in, they become increasingly insistent. Is that mapped to what you've heard?
Yes. Yes. In most instances, they become increasingly insistent. They will knock on the windows. And it never gets to the point of violence. At least I've never seen any story where it gets to the point of violence. It just becomes a cacophony of let me in, knock, 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 knock. And this will last for minutes to hours. Usually the person inside falls asleep or something. When they wake up, they've gone, and there's no more evidence for them being around. But they are very insistent. They will repeat this phrase, let me in, let me in. They'll give all kinds of excuses. They never lose their temper. They never raise their voice. It's always this hypnotic sort of effect that they use to try to convince you. And they also try to use your humanity. You know, they're small children out late at night, and you feel bad and want to protect them. And that's how they work.
What do you think the most frightening aspect of the black-eyed kids and the black-eyed demons are?
I think the most frightening aspect is, where are the people that let these people in?
Yeah.
I mean, I must have seen now 150 stories of various types. And in all of that, I've only seen two where these kids were let in and the consequences were unpleasant. And as I said in the book, I think it's, I can't remember that, it's a staggering number of people disappear every year in the United States alone. And I'm sure that many of them disappear for all kinds of good reason, but you have to suspect that if there is such a thing as the black-eyed kid, and the black-eyed kid really is demonic and feeding on human souls or human energy, then you know, the I think that's the terrifying bit to me, is where are all the people that actually let them in? Because I can't believe that most people don't. Otherwise, you know, why would they continue to knock on people's doors if they were never successful?
Now, is this something that we can any way research, or we're just kind of collecting stories? I mean, it's kind of difficult. It's kind of like ghost stories, or like an ethnographer would go out and collect information about different cultures. You just kind of, and I do the same thing with the campfire, just kind of collect stories. It's maybe frustrating because I don't even know how you would begin to research something like this to try to see if there's anything to it. You just kind of have to be in almost receiver mode.
You have to be in receiver mode, but I, like I say, when I wrote the first book, the Your Haunted Life 3, The Black Eyed Kids, I did really spend quite a lot of time researching, and you know, obviously I came across people like you mentioned his name, the other Black Eyed Kid, yeah. David Weatherly, and he's got some great information, and you know, I found stories on the internet that were much older. I found stories in books, for example, that came from, you know, 60 years ago. So, and I also looked at this whole concept of black-eyed demons, black-eyed beings, black-eyed humanoids. And I came to the conclusion that, you know, the boogeyman in all cultures seems to have black eyes. Whether they're hill fairies, whether they're soul-eating demons, black-eyed kids, or you know, some demon portrayed in a movie by Hollywood, they all seem to have black eyes. And as I said, in psychological accounts, there are also accounts of people developing sort of like a demonic temperament, unable to control their anger, also developing black eyes, which is a medical condition. So, you know, if it is an urban myth, then it brings together a lot of compelling aspects of how to create fear, how to create mystery, how to compel people to listen. And it brings it all together in a very clever and compelling way. But I just have to believe that there's got to be something behind it. And, you know, I guess the other aspect we haven't mentioned, I don't know if we've got time, sure, is that outside of the US, there are normal black-eyed kids, but there are also black-eyed ghosts and demonic black-eyed entities. So I can't remember whether it was 10 years ago or something like that, but there was a whole series. There was all these newspapers in the UK reporting about the black-eyed kids of Cannock Chase, which is by Birmingham, the city of Birmingham in England. And if you look at the Cannock Chase black-eyed kid, it's not a physical kid, it's a ghost, but the ghost has black eyes, pale skin, behaves in sort of the same way. So there's a, you know, when you look outside of the US, the stories with a lot of similarities with a sort of common theme, and yet there are these differences, not a physical being at all, but a ghost with black eyes. And this caused, I mean, if your listeners want to go and Google Cannock Chase black-eyed kid, you'll see that all of the newspapers in England, all of the you know, less highbrow newspapers, shall we say, picked up on this, and it was front page story for many months that these black-eyed kid ghosts were haunting this Cannock Chase forest. The other thing that sometimes is a common theme to these stories as well, which I find interesting, is that they seem sometimes to have the ability to disrupt electricity supply, phones, all those kind of things. So even though people want to make a telephone call, they'll pick up the phone and it's unusable, or the lights will flicker, that kind of thing, which, you know, is another little aspect to the story that that sort of strengthens the feeling of malevolence and fear and all of those kind of things. So for me, it's been a fascinating exploration so far, and I continue to get the stories. I continue to collect them. I continue to look for other stories as well online. And I'm a believer. I think there's definitely something behind this urban myth of the black-eyed kid.
Now, two things. One, please let us know where we can go if somebody out there has a black-eyed kid, a black-eyed adult, a black-eyed demon story, if they want to contribute it and share what's happened to them. And also, these two books, Your Haunted Lives, The Black-Eyed Kids, and The Black-Eyed Demons Are Coming. How can they get those as well?
Yeah, the website is called My Haunted Life 2, T-O-O, as opposed to T-W-O. And so it's myhauntedlife2.com. You can go there, submit your story, any ghost story, but particularly black-eyed kid stories. If it's good, it will get on the site. I have a relationship with a person who does, a podcast called Weird Darkness. He uses the stories and brings them to life on a weekly basis as well. And if it's really very good, I'll actually send you a code to get a free audiobook. And the two books, of course, can be found on any Amazon website. Just put in G. Michael Vasey or put in Black Eyed Kids, and you'll see the two books pop up. I would recommend the first one to sort of get an introduction, because it's more of an expose. There are stories, but it's more a sort of research into the phenomena, looks at the history, looks at the other stories, looks at human legend and sort of the human psychological aspects of it. And then the second shorter volume is a new set of stories that have been submitted over the last, 9 months or so, the best of them anyway.
Our guest has been G. Michael Vasey. We're talking about the Black Eyed Kids. Thank you so much for joining us today. Always a pleasure, and wow, what a fascinating topic, and continued success in everything you do.
Thanks, Jim. I always enjoy talking to you, and always like to be on the show. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, I certainly enjoyed talking to G. Michael Vasey and the Black Eyed Demons. Wow. You know, that's a subject, Black Eyed Demons. Some people call them Black Eyed Demons. Some people call them Black Eyed Kids. I call them terrifying. And next up, after this, we've got Len Kasten joining us. He's going to talk about Alien World Order right after this. I'm excited. You know, I don't get to go to a lot of conferences. Don't do a lot of that, maybe once or twice a year at the very most. And I'm very excited about the one coming up, because it's going to be near my hometown, within driving distance of the Cleveland area, definitely actually considered to be in the metro Cleveland area. And if you're in driving distance, I hope you come up and join us April 29th and 30th for the Kent Paranormal Weekend. That is the Kent Paranormal Weekend. You can find more information at thekentstage.com or facebook.com/Kent Paranormal Weekend. Now, if you ever wanted to meet me, I will be there. But more importantly, we have other great folks. Jeff Belanger, you know him from many books, his work on paranormal television, his own show, 30-odd minutes. Then we've got the great Nick Redfern, who's written multiple books on UFOs and cryptids and all host of the Fortean. The Housewives will be there. And many other ghost hunting groups and experts. We're going to have panels. I'll actually be leading those panel discussions on Saturday and Sunday. And I'll be giving a talk of my own about the Campfire Show and some of my favorite stories we've ever done. And I really recommend, if you're in driving distance, you come up and see us. It's April 29th and 30th. Very reasonable pricing. There's even a ghost hunt on one evening that's optional. You could pay a little extra and participate in that. But I think this is all going to be great fun. It is the Kent Paranormal Weekend, April 29th and 30th. You could get more information at thekentstage.com. That's thekentstage.com. And I hope to see you there. Some people believe that aliens are our space brothers. Well, that's not the perspective we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about Alien World Order, the reptilian plan to divide and conquer the human race. It's a new book out by our guest, Len Kasten. and I can't wait to dive into it. And Len is a great guest. He's been on the program before. He is a UFO researcher and freelance writer. He is a former member of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena and the UFO Mutual UFO Network. A feature writer with more than 50 published articles in Atlantis Rising and New Dawn magazines, and the author of The Secret History of Extraterrestrials and Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. He lives in Arizona. Len, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Jim. Nice to be with you.
I mean, that is an explosive title, Alien World Order, the reptilian plan to divide and conquer the human race. So you believe this is a very real thing and a very real threat?
Absolutely. I sure do.
So how did you kind of go down this particular rabbit hole? I mean, it's an explosive claim. And you obviously are very well steeped in UFO research. What got you going down this road and got you to this particular conclusion that this is going on?
You know, Jim, when I was a kid, I always felt like somehow the human race was controlled and enslaved in some way. I always had that feeling. It was a subconscious thing, but I knew we didn't have true freedom, even at the age of like 14. And slowly but surely over the years, as I did more and more UFO research, I began to understand that we were being controlled. And I wrote about that in my first book, Secret History of Extraterrestrials, in the introduction. So that's now, then when I, then thanks to David Icke's research, I began to see the whole picture. And then further research and further conversations, and began to understand what's going on. And so I decided it was necessary to write about it.
Is it fair to say that there are kind of good aliens and bad aliens, and the bad aliens want to enslave us and put them put us under their thumb?
The terms good and bad don't really apply, because the reptilians don't really know that they're bad, and they don't understand that they're bad. All they know is they want to dominate every civilization that they contact. They really do not have anything that we would recognize as affection or a heart chakra, any of that. That doesn't exist in their DNA. So to say that they're bad would be a misuse of the word. It's just that they are what they are, and they're here. And so we have to understand how to deal with them.
In the book, you talk about the era of the first Star Wars. What is the era of the first Star Wars?
You know, I was fortunate to have gotten my hands on a book by Robert Morningsky that is the only book that I know in existence that gives the history of the reptilians in this galaxy. And I thought it was absolutely necessary to cover that material before getting into how we're dealing with them. Because understanding where they come from, how they developed, all the phases that their civilization went through on a planet that Robert Morningsky calls the Green World, is necessary to really get a grip on how we have to deal with them here. Without that history, we don't understand. We're just talking about a bunch of aliens that have landed here and are trying to control us. That's not the case. That's not the case. The reptilians have a vast empire in this galaxy, and they're just trying to add us to their empire.
Do they look at us like we would look at so many ants?
Yes, they have contempt, utter contempt for us. They really do not respect us at all. And but the truth of the matter is that we are truly superior to them, and at some level they understand that, and that's why we're a great threat to them.
Now, you said they're here. How long have they been here, and how prevalent are they?
They've been here much longer than we have. According to Stuart Swerdlow, and I'm using Swerdlow as a source and a reference because I think he's got the truth of this whole thing, because he's had personal experiences with them at the Montauk site, Montauk, Long Island, from the age of 7, I believe. And so I think he knows, and according to him, they have been here in this solar system approximately 1 million years, 1 million years. They came here about 1 million years ago, and they were the ones that first settled this planet.
Now, saying that they're here on Earth, I mean, are they just undercover? We can't see them. Are they underground? Are they shapeshifters? Are they inbred, so to speak, with hybrids? All of the above. I mean, if they're here, I mean, why don't we see them or acknowledge that we see them?
All of the above would apply in this case. They originally dwelt on the surface of this planet when they first came here. In fact, when they arrived, according to Swerdlo, when they arrived in this solar system, the Earth was totally a water planet. It was covered almost entirely by ocean. And they had the technology and the power to actually move this planet further out into the solar system, and they dried it out, and two continents emerged. One was Lemuria, we call Lemuria. The other one was Atlantis, and they colonized it, Lemuria, around 300,000 years ago, and they lived on this planet for many thousands of years before the humans appeared.
Now, when we say reptilians, what do they look like? And I'm assuming, as we said, they can take multiple forms, but in their truest form, what do they look like?
Well, if you read the book, then you know what Robert Morningsky says about how they look. They are, over the years, they're not looking so scaly and reptilian anymore. They have developed more of a human form. They're humanoids. They have two arms and legs, head, and they were originally more like a crocodile in appearance, but they've now refined that over the evolution, through many, many, many thousands of years of evolution, they've refined that. And Morningsky says they even look attractive now, but they basically look like reptilians. They do not have lips like we do them. When their mouth is closed, you can't even see, it's just a slit. They have teeth. Their teeth are very sharp, and which they use to rip flesh, of course. And they have green, scaly skin, and they have the classical slit eyeballs. So they look reptilian, clearly, and you know you never mistake them.
So why don't we, if they're here, why don't we see them walking down the street or saying, oh my goodness, what is that? I mean, what are they doing to mask themselves and to cloak themselves?
Well, I think you've read the history there. What happened was they had originally destroyed three planets in the Lyra star system, and they had slaughtered 50 million humans that were dwelling there. Lyra was the origins of the human race in this galaxy. After that catastrophe, the humans scattered throughout the galaxy. Many of them had spacefaring technology, and some came here to this solar system. And at that point, there were only two planets they could dwell on here. One was Mars, and another was Maldek, which was a large planet between Mars and Jupiter. When the reptilians arrived here, what they did was they destroyed Maldek in the same way that they destroyed three planets in Lyra, using some sort of weaponry. We don't know. Maybe it was just the fact that they got so close to Maldek that just being the proximity alone could have caused it to explode. And as it went by Mars, it stripped the atmosphere off of Mars so that the Martians, the humans living on Mars, who were originally from Lyra, they were Lyra refugees, were forced to go underground to live on Mars. So by the time the reptilians created and settled this planet, the humans in this solar system were living mostly on Mars, underground. The Federation, which developed as a defensive operation or organization for the humans in this galaxy, decided that they were going to confront the reptilians in the solar system. They were not willing to let this solar system go. So they sent a very fierce race of humans from the Pleiades to settle on this planet, and that became Atlantis. And the Atlanteans had very sophisticated weaponry. They had what we call pulse weapons, electromagnetic pulse weapons. They were able to attack Lemuria and cause it to sink under the Pacific. And the Reptilians were forced at that point to go underground. And that is how their underground life began. And that was approximately 50,000 years ago. And that's when Atlantis started to develop. Now that it was free of reptilians on the surface, they were free to create their civilization, which was a very high civilization.
It is a fascinating topic. When we get back, I want to talk to Len about when did our leaders become aware, in his view, of the reptilians and their plan to divide and conquer the human race. The book is Alien World Order. Our guest is Len Kasten, and we'll be back right after this.
If you like the Paranormal Podcast, you'll want to check out Jim's other free podcasts. Be sure to tune in to Jim Harold's Campfire, Crime Scene, and TV You Grew Up With. You can find them at jimharold.com and wherever fine podcasts are heard. Check them out. Bet you can't listen to just one. Now we return to the Paranormal Podcast.
We're back on the Paranormal Podcast, a mind-bending discussion, a theory, an assertion that is certainly explosive in the new book, Alien World Order, The Reptilian Plan to Divide and Conquer the Human Race. We have the guest today, the author of said book, Len Kasten, and we're enjoying our conversation and kind of getting our mind blown here. So join us on this journey. Now, Len, this happened. The reptilians went underground. Fast forward to maybe the more modern era. And by modern era, I mean once humans kind of had advanced civilizations and all that. How far back was it that human leadership? And I mean, I don't know if we're talking about, you know, post-World War II or we're talking about ancient Egypt. How far back did human leadership know about the reptilians?
I say as far back as you want to go, really. They were not known to be, they're not known completely in terms of their educational systems so that it could be taught to their children, but many of the human leaders knew about the existence of the reptilians. But the reptilians are very, very smart, very clever. They stay underground, and they know that if they appear in their original form on the surface of the planet, they would, of course, be scary creatures. So they stay underground. Now, you know, we have to talk about Atlantis. Atlantis is the key to the whole thing.
Okay.
Because the Atlanteans knew about the reptilians, and they knew they were underground, and they knew they had to keep them there. And so there were many wars that broke out between the two civilizations for a long time. And the Atlanteans were very powerful. They had powerful weaponry. They even had atomic energy. So the reptilians had to stay underground, and they did for a very long time. But they did what they always do to conquer a planet. They hybridized the surface dwellers. That is to say, they would abduct them, they would use their DNA, mix it with theirs, so that they could actually function on the surface as hybrids, and they would not be recognized as reptilians. And that was how slowly, over many, many years, thousands of years, the Atlanteans were basically conquered, and Atlantis sank beneath the waves of the Atlantic. But those humans on Atlantis were not the same humans that we recognize today. So we have to discuss that too.
Well, tell us the differences.
Well, those humans were very advanced. They were direct descendants of the Lyrans. They had very sophisticated technology. They had very sophisticated spirituality. They were tall, shining beings, not like we are today. And they were, of course, their technology and their science was very advanced. So that was not the human race that we now call Homo sapiens sapiens. That was a different human race from a different star system. And when Atlantis sank, that was more or less the end of that particular civilization. Although some of them had already migrated all over the planet to South America, Central America, and to Tibet and places like that. And they stayed hidden. The Federation decided that in order to keep peace on this planet, it was necessary to convene a council. And the council was convened on the planet of Hitona, which is in the Andromeda galaxy, at which point it was agreed that they would create a new race here that would be mostly human, but would have some reptilian DNA. That was the agreement. And that's what we call the Garden of Eden. That happened about 50,000 years ago. Uh-huh. We are the descendants of that race. That is the human race to which we belong.
So we're partially reptilian.
Yes, we are. We have the reptilian brain. It's the deepest brain in the brain, and it's overlaid by the mammalian brain and the rational brain. But it's the reptilian brain, which they insisted on, that before they would agree to it, that unless we had reptilian DNA, they would not agree to the arrangement. And so that's the way it was done. And that part of our brain is what makes us so contentious and warlike in many ways.
So the reptilians at this point, I think, you know, if you accept the premise that there are reptilians, if you look at any kind of aggressive society or civilization, warlike civilization, or in this case species, you know, you kind of give them an inch and they take a foot. I mean, you just look at Nazi Germany, and I know that plays into this too, and we can talk about that a little bit, but you know, you sign up, you know, they invade one country, you sign a peace treaty, you're not going to go any further, and then they go further. Or you can even talk about America in terms of the Native Americans and what happened to them. You know, they went so far, they signed a treaty, and then they ripped up the treaty and it went all the way to California. So I guess I'm saying that it sounds like to me, and today look at North Korea. So it sounds like to me they made this deal, but never really intended to keep it. They intended to keep trying to progress and progress and progress. Am I right?
Yes, exactly. The reptilians have there's never been an agreement with the reptilians that they haven't broken. And that was mostly very, very clearly shown by their protege, Hitler, who never, ever kept an agreement he made.
Okay, so let's maybe bring it a little more into the modern day. Now, when many people have these kind of abduction scenarios, we believe that they are from out there. You know, medical experimentation, all of these different things. But is it possible in some cases, is it true in some cases that it's not from up above, but down below?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is from down below. But you see, they do have the ability to continue to do space travel. They can leave from any number of openings that they have. Antarctica is a good example. They have a very large colony under Antarctica, and that's why they invited Hitler and the Nazis to build their refuge there, adjacent to theirs. They can leave this planet, but we can't, really. They can travel to their home planet in Draco and continue to supplement their forces here anytime they want, but we can't because they put a blanket over us, and we have been kept from traveling to the stars. We could have been traveling to the stars a long time ago if it hadn't been for that. So when people are abducted by spacecraft, they could have come from below, they could have come from above, but more than likely, they've come from below.
Now, let's talk about maybe the World War II era. Was it basically the Nazis in league with the reptilians against the Allied powers? I mean, how did that work? Why did the reptilians say, you know, those Nazis, that's something that they wanted to align themselves with? I mean, why was there this kind of alliance? So what spurred it? And talk to us about that, because I think that's extremely creepy.
Yeah, before we discuss that, though, we have to get into the subject of the Illuminati.
Okay.
Those are humans that have a very large percentage of reptilian blood. They were hybrids that were created by the reptilians, part human, part reptilian, but mostly they don't have a human soul, put it that way. They're really aliens. So, and they're able to shapeshift. A lot of the Illuminati are able to shapeshift, which is to appear human when they need to. The Illuminati are running our planet, essentially. They run the media, they run the banks, they own all the wealth on this planet. Everywhere the reptilians go in this galaxy, and they now control approximately 21 star systems, they create central banks, because a central bank gives them the capability and the flexibility to endorse certain causes and to destroy certain causes. And that means that they can use the money to start a war whenever they choose to. And so that's what they did. That's what World War I and World War II was all about. But before that, they were using religion. And I made that point in the book, that their first attempt to control humanity was through religion. And when that failed, that's when they turned to war.
And so for that Nazi reptilian league, how did that come about?
Well, the reptilians used, through the Illuminati that they had under their control, they created the fascist philosophy and the fascist powers in the three countries that we know about, Italy, Germany, and Japan. And they made sure that the emperor of Japan, whose bloodline they knew about going back all the way to the 6th century, they knew he was under reptilian control, and so was Hitler, because Hitler was really basically a Rothschild, and the Rothschilds are known to be reptilian. So that's how they did it. That's how they did it. In World War I, it was through the Kaiser, who also had blue blood. What we call the blue bloods were really people with a high degree of reptilian blood, because they had a high copper. Their blood had a high copper content, so we call them blue bloods. And they ran Europe and the world for a long time.
Now, where did the U.S. and the Allied powers come down on this? In other words, during the Second World War, to your mind, there was this league of the reptilians and the Nazis. Were the Allied powers aware of this, and did they have ET allies of any type, or was it basically the allies versus the Nazis, the Japanese, the Italians, and the reptilians?
The Federation, which includes the Pleiades and the Pleiadians and the Andromedans and the Procyon, they of course were on our side, but they couldn't do it for us. The Pleiadians did meet with Roosevelt, I believe. According to Al Bielek, representatives of the Pleiadians met with Roosevelt on the Missouri in mid-Pacific in 1933. That's speculation, partly speculation, but Bielek was very accurate about a lot of things.
Yeah, he did a lot of work on the Philadelphia experiment, correct?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he did. And he was a very smart guy and very much involved in all of this. But the fascist movement was an attempt to take over the planet and enslave it through the Illuminati. It was an overt attempt to enslave the human race. I mean, if you look at what happened at Auschwitz and all the concentration camps, that would have been the entire planet if they had won. The entire planet would have looked like Auschwitz. Okay? And the reptilians would be in control. They failed to do that because we had some very strong allies on our side. And we had some very smart people on our side, and the Pleiadians helped us in any way they could, and the Andromedans helped us any way they could, but they couldn't do it for us. We had to do it ourselves, and thanks to the bravery of the American soldiers and the American military, we were able to prevail. Thank God for that.
So it interests me because post-war, you talk about things like Operation Paperclip, where the German scientists were brought into the fold of the U.S. to help with the rocketry and so forth and all of this. did the reptilians play a part in that? I think you have some theories in that regard.
Well, the reptilians were behind the Nazis from the beginning, and they shared an underground facility in Antarctica from 1938 on. In fact, it was the most highly technological people in the Nazi civilization that went to Antarctica. So, what was the question?
The question was that we're talking about Operation Paperclip and the bringing of the German scientist into the fold.
The reptilians were behind the Nazi movement. Okay, after World War II, they managed to infiltrate America through Paperclip and through people like Alan Dulles, who was sympathetic to the Nazi cause. And so they constituted the early development of the CIA. And Paperclip, we took in about 1,600 Nazi scientists, many of them, if not most of them, who had blood on their hands and who had been involved in the cruelest and in the most sadistic practices of the Third Reich. They came here, and slowly but surely, the Nazi influence in America started to take over. Now, Ike was aware of all of this, Eisenhower, but there was nothing he could do about it. But he did warn us in that speech he made in 1961 about the military-industrial complex. And we should all go back and reread that speech because it's very important, very apropos.
Yeah, that's fascinating that someone of his level, he'd been the supreme commander of the Allied forces, the president for two terms, that he would come out and say something that striking. That has always fascinated me, the fact that he came out in his farewell address and made those strong statements.
Yeah, because he knew what was happening. Don't forget that the name of his book was Crusade in Europe. He used the word crusade. That was deliberate, because it really was a crusade against an evil force that was trying to take over the planet. And the human race, which was still we're still rather young as a race, because we only began around 40,000 years ago, was vulnerable to a takeover. But as we've developed more and more technologically and spiritually, we're now becoming more and more of a real adversary against the reptilians. So that kind of a takeover is no longer possible, because the human race has expanded its consciousness now. And they're going to have to take a whole different attack, a whole different viewpoint in order to conquer the human race at this point.
So seeing that, what is their plan today? I mean, seeing that humanity has evolved in terms of technology and hopefully spiritually, in your view, these reptilians who are, you know, out to get us, how are they going to do it? What do you think their battle plan is?
They do it like they've done it in 21 other star systems. They hybridize. They abduct humans. They mix their DNA with the reptilian DNA. They become hybrids. And they have created millions and millions of hybrids already all over this planet. And they're walking in our cities. They're walking in all of our civilization, in our entire civilization. The book to read about that, the best resource on that, is the book Walking Among Us by David Jacobs. I would recommend that book highly. He is a therapist and a hypnotist. So he has direct experience with these hybrids. And he's learned to recognize them and how to identify them. So that's like a must. That's like a primer to the whole story, that book.
And he's been a guest on the show, and fascinating. Very, very interesting.
David's a great guy, and he's very, very smart.
Well, I mean, there's really too much to delve into here. I mean, there's so much in this book. If you're interested in the subject matter, you've got a really attractive kind of color images in the middle, glossy images kind of showing some different things here. One thing I do want to ask you about, because this really, you know, and I'll be very honest, I'm somewhat skeptical of this theory. However, one thing that really does catch my eye or ear is I just talked to another author about this the other day. I was reading Wired magazine, and I can't recall who it was. It wasn't Elon Musk or any huge name like that, but there was one of the Techgentsia talking about, hey, you know, the internet's going to be implanted into us and we're probably not going to be able to turn it off. Now, let me say, I love technology. I'm blessed to have this job doing podcasts because of technology. I think the internet is fantastic. I think technology is great. Of course, like anything else, it can be used for good or for evil. That being said, I don't like the idea of the internet being implanted into me and I can't turn it off. That seems like a bridge too far. And I know that you tackled the idea of transhumanism. Where does transhumanism come in to play in this whole scope of things?
According to my understanding, that is the current reptilian plan to conquer the human race, is to create hybrids, create a huge population of hybrids, which they've already done and they're still doing, and read Jacob's book to get the inside story on that. But also to create robotic entities through transhumanism, which they too would be entities that do not have a human soul and would be allied with the hybrids. And once a certain point is reached, which they call the singularity, where robotic entities or robotic creatures would be just about equal to humans in terms of intelligence, they would be in a position to take over, because then all they need to do is to create something like another world war or a plague or something to wipe out, let's say, perhaps 75% of the spiritually based humans. And then the combination of the hybrid race, the artificial creatures, the robotics, would be in a position to take over the planet and kick the rest of us out or enslave us. That's the plan. That's their plan. And I described that in the last chapter of my book.
Well, I've really appreciated this time, and I love looking at things that are outside the comfort zone, because it makes you think. And I think if you read this book, you will think. And our guest today has been Len Kasdan. The book is Alien World Order, The Reptilian Plan to Divide and Conquer the Human Race. Len, where can people find the book and more information on all of your work?
Okay, the book is available on Amazon or on Barnes & Noble, and also through the publisher, Inner Traditions in Rochester, Vermont. Also, I will have the ability to order it through my website, which is still under construction. The website is www.et-secrethistory.net, N-E-T. And right now it's out there, but I need to put in the ability to order the book through the website. So I would suggest getting it through Amazon.
Well, again, a fascinating discussion. Len Kasdan, thank you for your time today.
Same here, Jim. Nice talking with you. Take care.
A lot to unpack there and to think about. Alien World Order, and earlier we were joined by G. Michael Vasey talking about the black-eyed demons. We hope that you enjoyed this show, even if it was a little bit terrifying, and we hope that you will subscribe to the show so you get it automatically every time we put out a new show. If you listen on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or wherever you may listen, rate and review us. Spread the word. That's how we get the word out. So I appreciate that very much. And hope to see you over at the Kent Paranormal Weekend. If you're in driving distance of Northeast Ohio, April 29th and 30th, I'll be there. Jeff Belanger, Nick Redfern, and many more. And I think that you will enjoy it. Check that out at thekentstage.com. We thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time. And have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.